The Bitchery of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can get a free audiobook and start your free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery. Hey guys!
Hello! And welcome to week 25 of
the Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Mother Noella Marcellino.
Ooh, that's a cool name.
Yes.
I am going to be talking about Nettie Stevens.
Oh, yeah. Alrighty. We heard about that one from our associate producer, Chris McNeil.
Yes, indeed.
Alrighty. So Mother Noella was born Martha A. Marcellino on June 30th, 1951. I couldn't find where she was born, mostly because I believe when nuns take their vows, they release a lot of those ties.
Right.
So she's not really written about in terms of where she's from, but her brother Jocko is the drummer from Shanana, and he's from Quincy, Massachusetts.
Okay.
So we can, I think it's safe to assume that she was too, since they come from a family of six kids.
Right.
And they're all from Massachusetts.
Cool.
So they were born and raised there. She was a college dropout, and then in 1970, she came to the Abbey of Regina Laudis, which is in Bethlehem, Connecticut, for a religious retreat, or for a retreat.
Okay.
And now, this abbey, Regina Laudis, is it's a Benedictine order of nuns, all women, obviously, and they're essentially self-sufficient. This abbey, they have a pottery studio, bees, cows, hogs, an herbal tea garden, which is why you'd want to go.
Yes, that's definitely why I would want to go.
And a smith shop. Ooh. Sitting on a 360 acres of farmland.
Gorgeous.
Right?
Ready. Sign me up.
That's where I want to go. And they believe that to get closer to God, they each have a vocation of some sort. They each do some kind of job on the farm itself.
Nice.
And she said, it wasn't as if we went shopping for an abbey. We went to this place, and there were such great women there, such a great spirit.
Mm.
It took us, and then we discovered we had religious vocations.
Wow.
So she joins the abbey in 1971 after going there for this weekend retreat. She's a cow milker for her first years there till 1977, when she takes over the cheese making of the abbey. And she eventually would be named their official cheese maker.
Nice.
But at first, it didn't go very well because she had no clue how to make cheese. She was from a Sicilian family that really didn't have cheese in it.
Okay.
I mean, Southern Italians don't use much cheese, especially like age-ripened cheese,
right,
or moldy cheeses, which is what this Bethlehem cheese and then eventually the Saint Nectaire cheese, which she begins making. These are both moldy cheeses.
Okay.
And I want one so badly. It looks so good. But it's like $300 to $400 for a wheel.
What? Whoa.
But when you're buying cheese made by the cheese nun, so she becomes the cheesemaker in 1977, and it doesn't really go well until they invite this woman who was a native to the Auvergne in France, who teaches her how to make cheese in this wooden barrel, this Saint Nectaire type of cheese. And so she begins making this cheese, and they're very good at it. But then in 1985, there's a listeria outbreak in Southern California, where about 25 to 26 people died from the listeria outbreak.
Yikes.
And it ends up eventually that it was because some raw milk had been added into some pasteurized milk, and there had been bacteria in the raw milk that caused the listeria.
Okay.
And it was in this like Mexican cheese here in Southern California. And so the FDA cracked down on cheesemakers around the country.
Right.
And they came in and they saw that she was making cheese in these wooden barrels. And they were like, no, you can't use wood. That's how bacteria is spread. You have to use stainless steel or you have to use some kind of metal. They said, okay, at first. And they tried to start making it, but it didn't come out right. The cheese didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
1985, I should say, is also the same year she becomes the mother of the abbey. She gets named as the mother of the abbey.
Nice.
And the priest or the bishop who has say over the abbey, he allowed four of the nuns from the abbey to go to school in order so that this abbey, which they're very self-sufficient, they have animals and all that kind of stuff, so that they could do it in a way that complied with the FDA, but that they could still be self-sufficient.
Right.
So they sent four nuns to the University of Connecticut, and they all got doctorates in different things.
Sweet.
Mother Noella got her doctorate in microbiology.
Whoa, okay.
And then the three other nuns got doctorates in animal science, plant science, and agronomy, which is the science of turning naturally grown both plant and animal products into human food. So she goes to the University of Connecticut, where she gets her undergraduate degree. She then receives a Fulbright scholarship to study in France. At first, her thesis is she wants to study mold in ancient cheese caves around France. And that ends up being too big of too broad of a thesis. And so she focuses on this one strain of mold called Geotrichum candidum, which is the prime mold in the cheese that she makes at the Abbey. So it makes sense.
Okay.
And she goes to these caves, and she's literally, like, the stories that I've read, she's up on a ladder, like, at the top of caves with this sterile, with a sterile scalpel, like, scraping at the top of these caves. She collects 160 different samples from 11 different, both cheese caves and well-known and established cheese makers throughout the south of France, and ends up isolating 64 different strains of this one different mold, as well as she figured out and was able to categorize how they combined in different ways in order to create different kinds of cheeses.
Huh.
Not only do the molds create the cheeses themselves, but the way that they interact prepares the cheese rind so that other molds can take hold and then form other kinds of cheeses. Watch this really cool documentary, and it's part of the Cooked series on Netflix.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's the one called Earth, and it's all about fermentation. And they talk on there about, they call her Sister Noella at the time, because I mean, technically she is still sister, but she is mother now. They talk about, they've got some microbiologists there who talk about how it's a little like a forest. And when a farmer, so like, let's say you have a farmer who's abandoned a field.
Right.
Eventually, at first, these little weeds come in and they take over and they give nutrients to the soil and they churn up the soil. And then shrubs come in and then eventually trees come in. And so you get a forest eventually, but it takes all of these other little pre-species and pre-plants to prepare the ground and prepare the soil. And it's literally the exact same thing that happens on the rind of a cheese when it's being processed. And so one of the things that they've been doing, and one of the things that is coming out of the study of how cheese matures and how cheese is created, is a study of biology itself, study of plants. Because the creation of a forest sometimes can take 100, 150, sometimes much longer than that. But on cheese, it happens in a couple months. So by being able to study it in that kind of time span, you can blow it up and see how it works on an ecological scale, on an actual big scale.
Very cool.
Talk about undirected scientific research, right? So after her Fulbright scholarship in France, she gets a four-year fellowship from the Institut National de la Recherche Agronomique, which is essentially a grant from the French government to keep studying cheese. And she receives her doctorate in microbiology in 2003 from the University of Connecticut. Her thesis was titled, Diversity of Geotrichum candidum strains isolated in traditional cheesemaking fabrications in France.
Say that three times fast.
So what was even more amazing from her studies was that she was able to show how cheesemakers in France throughout the centuries have been able to select for the perfect bacteria to make different cheeses without degrees in microbiology. For centuries, I mean, these people have been able to, these cheesemakers got so good at their craft and so good at knowing how this cheese was made and like what went into it, that they could isolate for specific strains with repetition and being able to replicate it.
They're just domesticating cheeses.
Exactly. It's exactly what it is. So she was given the nickname the Cheese Nun in a documentary of the same name, which was produced by the Paris American Television Company and aired on PBS in 2006. She won the French Food Spirit Award in Scientific Advancement, which I have to say is an award that only could be given out in France, or maybe Italy as well.
Right.
The French Food Spirit Award in Scientific Advancement from the French Senate in 2003. It's given out for the French government itself.
Whoa.
She won the International Academy of... She won an honor, and she was honored at a convention of the International Academy of Gastronomy, and she won their Grand Prix de la Science de l'Alimentation in 2005, which came from that PBS documentary before it aired on PBS, did the festival circuit, and she like went on the festival circuit with it.
Whoa.
And
they, yeah.
She was the scholar in residence at the 2011 American Cheese Society Conference in Montreal, and she is now the official cheesemaker as well as the mother of the Abbey in Bethlehem, Connecticut.
That's so cool.
She is amazing. And if you watch that documentary, I just want to spend a week with her, like learning how to make cheese and just living with those nuns, because I feel like it would just make my life.
You would be really happy there.
I would be so happy.
That's awesome.
So thanks. That's Mother Noella. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing. Once again, we've picked people with kind of a similar...
Oh, yeah?
...thing.
Okay.
Because Nettie Stevens is also a scientist.
Oh.
She didn't do microbiology. Okay. She didn't go into that as much.
Mm-hmm.
She was more into the genetics side of biology.
Mm-hmm.
Biology is a huge number of disciplines within it.
Mm-hmm.
But Nettie Stevens, who was sent to us by Chris McNeil, is another Google Doodle. So shout out to Google for featuring these awesome women.
Love Google.
So we can know more about them.
Yes, ma'am.
She was born Nettie Maria Stevens on July 7th, 1861 in Cavendish, Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up, she taught high school, she was a librarian, and then after teaching for 3 terms, she continued her education at Westfield Normal School in Massachusetts. She completed their 4-year course in 2 years and graduated with the highest score in her class.
Love, yes.
Just casual. Story of my life. Story of her life. She then attended Stanford University, where she received her BA in 1899 and her MA in 1900. So just like a year, super fast, no problem.
Nice.
No worries. She also completed 1 year of graduate work in physiology under Professor Jenkins and 1 year of histology and cytology under Professor McFarland. Stevens continued her studies in cytology at Bryn Mawr College, where she obtained her PhD.
Nice.
And she was really influenced when she got there by the work of the previous head of the biology department, Edmund Beecher Wilson, and his successor, Thomas Hunt Morgan. And so her research took her into determining what makes a person male or female.
Oh, interesting.
If it was, no one knew. Chromosomes? What are these things?
Yeah.
We don't know. Where it's like, you're just going to pop out and we'll find out.
And let's blame the woman if it's wrong.
Well, Aristotle, going way back, believed a child's sex was determined by the body temperature of the father during sex.
Oh, interesting.
So he counseled elderly men to conceive in the summer if they wish to have male heirs. So I guess...
Interesting. There is some natural reason to believe that. Because, for example, alligators, their eggs, if the eggs are above a certain temperature, all the eggs will be born male. The same eggs, if they're all below a certain temperature, they'll all be born female. And if they're raised between a certain temperature, you'll have a mix of the genders.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Life finds a way.
Life finds a way.
In 19th century Europe, it was widely believed that nutrition was what would cause a certain sex to be born. So interestingly though, I feel like this is the opposite of what I expect. poor nutrition leads to males and good nutrition leads to females. Isn't that the opposite of what you would think? I would feel eat all the meat pies and the haggis and the potatoes and have all the men. And it will be like, eat just like, nibble on some wild grass and you'll have a girl. But it's apparently, that's not...
I love it.
It's
maybe because women like need the ability to create life or something.
I mean, we've never really gotten the respect we deserve for that, but you're welcome for not letting the whole human population die out.
I mean, I'm about it. You know I'm about it.
So, I don't know. So, and then in 18th century France, the French anatomist Michel Procope Couteau believed that testicles and ovaries were either male or female. So he suggested that the best way to determine your child's sex, or to, I guess, kind of pick what you wanted, if you wanted to, was just remove the testes or the ovary connected with the unwanted sex. So the same French anatomist also just suggested a slightly easier way to control the child's sex was just to have ladies, quote, lie on the correct side and let gravity do the rest, end Interesting. Quote. So, you know, in the early 1900s, the idea that there was anything called DNA or chromosomes or any sort of genetics that would determine anything about you, much less your sex, was still very new and considered a little bit of a crazy theory. Gregor Mendel, who, of course, you know from all the pea plants that you read about in all of your science textbooks. Right,
those Punnett squares.
Exactly. Punnett squares, I think.
Punnett squares, yep, that's right.
Yeah. I think a Punnett's a flag. Who knows?
It is, yeah.
His works were only recently rediscovered in 1900. He really had no audience for his ideas when he was alive. He wasn't taken very seriously.
He was a monk, wasn't he? Or something like that?
I'm not sure. It's a question for my sister. She loves genetics.
Oh, okay.
So the scientific community was trying to work out how specific traits are passed on, how they're determined, including how your sex is determined and how that's passed through the generation. So Stevens wanted to know how and if sex was passed on through genetic inheritance, if that was part of it. And she was making observations with her microscope of the chromosomes in the Tenebrio molitor, the mealworm beetle.
Aww.
And that's when she discovered something that eluded humanity forever.
Yeah.
And she found that the female mealworm cells had 20 large chromosomes. The male had 20 chromosomes as well, but the 20th was notably smaller than the other 19.
Okay.
And she said, quote, "This seems to be a clear case of sex determination," end quote.
Cool.
So she wrote a report summarizing her findings, and she correctly concluded that this difference could be traced back to the differences in the mealworm sperm. So the sperm either had the small version of the 20th chromosome or the large one. So the sperm that contained the small chromosome determined the male sex, she wrote, and those that contain 10 chromosomes of equal size determine the female sex. She didn't call them X and Y chromosomes. We didn't have terms for that yet. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. It's generally stated that E.B. Wilson obtained the same results as Stevens at the same time, and he probably did arrive at his conclusion on sex determination, but after he had seen Stevens' results.
Oh.
But because of Wilson's more substantial contributions in other areas, maybe also because he has a penis, I'm just saying, who knows, he tends to be given most of the credit for this discovery, not Nettie Stevens. Also, it is a fact Wilson's paper was published before Stevens, and because he was the man with the higher reputation, more well-known than she was, you know, he's been credited with discovery. Right. But Stevens presented a stronger and ultimately more correct conclusion in the determination of the chromosomes.
I see it.
So it's kind of thanks to Nettie Stevens. We know what's what. We know what's up. At 50 years old, only 9 years after she completed her PhD, Stevens actually died of breast cancer in Baltimore, Maryland.
Oh, no.
Her career span was pretty short, but she published
40 papers.
Wow.
So she really made the most of her time.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's Nettie Stevens.
A woman on the edge of what we thought was already the edge. She was on the cutting edge.
Yes, very much so.
I love it. Well, thanks so much for sharing.
Of course.
That's a really great story. That's really interesting. I love hearing about those things where we think it's one person who got there first and really it was...
Right. Another person.
Another person.
Hashtag usually
a woman.
Women.
Yeah. Usually. Exactly. Usually woman. Usually. Or a man taking credit for the thing that the
there
women
you go.
Did.
Exactly.
Right. So we'd like to take a moment to talk about our partners at audible.com. You can start your free trial today by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery and downloading any of tens of thousands of books.
You can check out, if you want, First Test by Tamora Pierce. She has actually written dozens of books that all take place in this one mythical land,
mm-hmm.
kind of Game of Thrones style.
Mm-hmm.
They are young adult books, so they're a little less violent for sure,
okay.
a little less bloodshed, mm-hmm. but they're fantastic. First Test is the first in a quartet. Most of her series are quartets,
right.
featuring this young girl, starts out young girl named Kelladry. She eventually rises to become a knight in the kingdom, and she is the first woman to go to night training school in like 100 years.
Wow.
And I love the books growing up. I still love them because Kelladry really just trains as hard as the boys. Actually, she mm-hmm. trains harder than them to
wow.
achieve her goal. She's not,
nice.
It's not about like, oh, she's so pretty, so they let her pass, or she's manipulative or whatever. Like, she gets up at 5 a.m. and goes and works out with her sword.
Love.
It's great.
Fantastic.
So you can check that out.
What was the name again?
That's First Test, the first book of The Protector of the Small Quartet by Tamora Pierce. You can grab that at audibletrial.com/bitchery. So, today in history?
Yes.
We got some good ones.
We did get
week.
Some good ones. So, on July 20th, 1960, Sirimavo Bandaranaike was elected as the first prime minister of Ceylon, which is in Sri Lanka,
mm-hmm.
which also made her the first female prime minister anywhere in the world.
We gotta do an episode
we
on
have
her.
To do her. I think I'm gonna do
Sweet.
Her in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, definitely. On July 21st, 1656, Elizabeth Key won her Virginia lawsuit to be recognized as a free woman, which actually led to the passage of more restrictive race-based slave laws.
Interesting.
But still, good for you, Elizabeth Key.
Absolutely.
This is another story I'd love to look into.
Also interesting how history repeats itself. Every time people of a minority class get freedoms through the court system,
right.
the reaction from the legislative system is always, well, you might have won that right, but you're not going to win these rights.
Right.
And then July 19th to the 20th in 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention was held, the country's first women's rights convention.
Woo!
Yes.
Go ladies.
Yes, ma'am.
Speaking of awesome ladies, our term this week, if we can mm-hmm. call it a term this week, is we're going to talk about Rosie the Riveter. If you've noticed, that's kind of our logo.
Mm-hmm.
It's on all our Facebook page, our Instagram, all of that. And I just wanted to talk about it a little bit because it put me in mind of when you were talking about Joan of Arc, when you did mm-hmm. your episode on her. I think it's such a well-known picture.
It's
and
iconic.
It's iconic, and it's, I don't want to say it's spoofed, because a lot of times they're very serious
mm-hmm.
replacements of
it's
Rosie.
It's paid homage to a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
Furiosa got one. Just saying, that's pretty great. But, I mean, there's tons
mm-hmm.
of other
yeah.
women and characters
it
that are seen in that position.
Part of the default iconography of the feminist movement. Just like the rainbow flag is.
And almost pop culture in general.
Absolutely,
yeah.
absolutely.
But yes, very similar to the rainbow flag. So I just want to take a moment and kind of remember that character or
mm-hmm.
that photo or
absolutely.
That picture, I should say, that picture is based on real people
mm-hmm.
and real women. The inspiration for the painting actually comes from Geraldine Hoff Doyle. She died in December 2010 at the age of 86, but she was 17 years old working at a metal factory in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when a visiting United Press international photographer snapped a picture of her on the job, and that kind of led to
yeah.
the Rosie the Riveter mm-hmm. movement. And what the Rosie the Riveter movement then led to is kind of the start of the women's
absolutely.
Rights and the feminist movement, because
absolutely.
So many women and young girls went into factories and into all of these hard labor jobs and just jobs in general because so many men were gone during World War II. Mm-hmm. That then when the war ended and all the men came back and wanted their jobs back and the women back in the kitchen, we were a little bit, we didn't want to go back.
Right.
We didn't want to go there again.
Yeah. And not only did we have a taste of what could be, but also we were able to prove, or women were able to prove, that they could be a vital and viable part of the workforce. Mm. So why would you go back to doing something you didn't want to if you didn't want to?
Right. Exactly.
Right?
Choice. Pro-choice.
Choice. It's all about choice and the freedom to make the choice.
Yes.
It's also interesting to note that Rosie the Riveter, as we have it, mm-hmm. is in the public domain because mm-hmm. it was created by the U.S. government for the war effort.
Right.
The one created by Norman Rockwell, which sold for almost $5 million, that one's not in the public domain. But our Rosie, the one that we've used to start our movement mm-hmm. with, our podcast with, is in the public domain. So listeners, if you want to use her. She's not ours. She's everyone's together. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
This was great.
That was a great episode.
I love learning about cheese. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much.
If you want to check out more photos of Rosie the Riveter, or you have maybe some cool versions that you've seen that you'd like to share.
Post your favorite version.
Yeah, you can find that and post it on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/UMPBOH. Or you can tweet at us or tag us on Instagram, mm-hmm. also at UMPBOH. Yeah.
Hashtag also UMPBOH, The Bitchery of History, Ursula Major Productions. We'll see all of them. I'm following all those tags.
Sweet.
Yes. If you'd like to support us for just a couple dollars a day or a couple cents a podcast, you can do that at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor.
Thank you to all of those who are already supporting us on there. We really appreciate it. It let us come to you in HD, so continue to support us and we'll get better and better for you.
Yes. It also helps pay for our advertising, which helped us hit more than 27,000 downloads this week in more than 53 countries. Which include Syria, Saudi Arabia, Ghana, which is still our number one, yes. Nigeria, Angola. We are reaching all over the world.
Thank you so much.
The Bitchery of History is hosted by the two of us, Allison and Max, with associate producer Chris McNeil, intern Katie Chang, and contributors Grace Seaman and Ella Moore.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.
Hey guys, Allison here. Thank you again so much for listening. It really means the world to me that there are people around the world now hearing the stories of these amazing women. If you want to help us out but you don't have the ability to contribute on Patreon, I totally understand. You can help us out just by giving us a few stars or a rating or a review on whatever platform you're listening on, Stitcher, Podomatic, Google Play, iTunes. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. Thanks.